Welcome to Toy Business Unboxed, your gateway to the secrets of the toy industry. Here, Jason Shea, a toy entrepreneur and expert in the field.
Every product we develop is really inspired by some of the real life experience that we have with our son.
60% of all toys last year were sold on Amazon, which is incredible.
Be passionate about it because it's a road, it's a journey.
Like when you have an idea that you think is like gonna somewhat like change the world, make things better, I'd say go for it.
We'll guide you through the enchanting world of toy design, marketing, and manufacturing. Now let the unboxing begin.
Welcome to another episode of Toy Business Unboxed. I'm your host, Jason Shea. And today I'm calling in from my new office in Tijuana, Mexico. And today we're thrilled to have John as our guest. And John is a seasoned entrepreneur, and he was also an optical engineer, which is a very interesting background. He has made significant contribution in the toy industry. He has done a lot of different projects over his career as an engineer and also as an entrepreneur. In today's episode, we'll be uncovering some of the journey behind some of the innovative product that he has designed over his career. And also, even maybe get to see some demo of some of the new product that he's working on. Thank you for joining me on the podcast today, John.
Thank you, Jason. It's been a pleasure to learn about you and your journey in entrepreneurship and the toy industry. And I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to have a conversation.
Can you start off by telling our audience a little bit about your background and how do you even started the current company that you have?
Sure. I can say with some certainty, I'm completely unqualified for the job that I have now. My college background was at a liberal arts college and I was a history major. And my job is managing and running a team of physicists who are experts in optical engineering. I have no background in science or engineering, but after 22 years of doing this, I guess I've learned enough to be able to keep the company rolling and keep our engineers on track. So what we do is, and the name of the company that I run and started is called Optics for Hire. An optical engineer is someone who designs systems that use light at its most basic. Could be collecting light, the way a camera, cell phone camera collects light, or sending light, the way a street light sends light, or a laser. And those systems are used in billions of products and hundreds of thousands of applications.
Mm-hmm.
So robots use lots of optics, self-driving cars, street lights, the little glowing light on your ring doorbell, medical devices that are looking at your body or your eye. You go to the ear doctor and he's got an optical system, an otoscope that's got some illumination that's illuminating your eardrum, and then imaging it as well. Behind all of those systems, there needs to be somebody designing the lens to send the light or collect the light. And that's what our engineers do. They're using simulated programs to design lenses that are collecting light, sending light, and then designing mechanical packages and electronic systems around it to manage the light or do signal processing. So it's been a fun and interesting journey. And as I alluded to, it's used in all kinds of different products. So our customers have been anywhere from Amazon to startup companies. We worked on actually the world's most successful, fastest selling toy, especially product, was in around mid-2000s. It was the Xbox Kinect. And that system had this motion capture where sort of a random pattern of infrared dots that was projected onto a scene. And then the camera collected that information and determined what the person playing the video game, how they were moving. So that was a product that we play a small role in. And so we're designing and modeling these systems and then also helping people make prototypes, not so much involved in the production of those units. So we've touched the toy industry, but we've touched a lot of industries. I mentioned Xbox Kinect. Another one that's related to the toy industry is that there was a Barbie doll a few years ago, maybe 12 years ago, that had a camera in the back of the head.
Yes.
And then the image that you collected with that camera was projected onto the Barbie doll's t-shirt.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So Mattel doesn't have a ton of, probably I don't think has any optical engineers. So they needed help from an outside company to help them with that. And that's the kind of thing that we did. In that case, we were looking at different ways to make the image on the shirt as nice as possible. And that was a funny one because we usually, when we're making our products, we'll send it back and forth. And I have offices overseas, as you do. So I have offices in Ukraine and also in Belarus. And I sent the Barbie doll and it was returned. And it's the only time that's ever happened to me. We work on government stuff or military stuff usually. But the customs agency thought that this was a spy device. And they said, no, thanks. We don't want it. Send it back. So my team never got to give it to their kids or use. You know, you never know what. We have a customer in South Africa now who's growing acres of indoor marijuana. So, you know, they need bright light to grow the marijuana plant with the right wavelength, right color. You just never know the solar projects, tattoo removals. So we had a customer that was, I don't know if you have any tattoos, but the lasers that they use to remove the tattoos are very powerful and it looks like it really hurts.
Well, I don't have any tattoos.
Yeah. I never really considered one. I definitely didn't after watching and helping design the tattoo removal lasers. Because they'll burn wood and they zap this thing to zap the pigment out of your skin. You need an optical engineer to design a laser system for
done whole kind of crazy project.
Tattoo removal.
On our previous conversation before the interview, I think in 2016 you began licensing some of your own toy invention as well. What motivated you to make the shift from just consulting with other people to like creating product of yourself?
It was just really by chance. We had a customer who had some experience at selling toys and actually selling books. He had a very successful book series that included pages that kind of animated as you turned them. And he had an idea for a toy, which, you know, like a lot of projects, it didn't work. And you still have to go down the road because the path from it didn't work to something that works, you just have to follow that path. So his idea was that we would have a toy that would make kind of a 3D object floating in space. And there would be kind of a panel, almost like a small little racket with a whole bunch of little LEDs on it.
Yeah.
We'd spin it around really fast. And because each LED at any second was in three-dimensional space, you could turn on or turn off the LEDs and make it look like there was a little figure or a little...
With you, I'd love to.
I don't have that one with me. When I say fail, it worked. It was cool. It looked good. But that is only like the first part of making a successful product. Coolly or more important is what is the price that you can make this thing?
True.
And that thing, you needed 50 LEDs. You need a powerful motor to spin it around. You needed some batteries. And as you start to add up all these costs, even if it's 25 cents here, all of a sudden it starts to go and go. And then you say, who's going to buy a $300 toy? Because the way the market works is if you manufacture it, the price of the consumer is four, maybe five times more than what it costs to make.
If
it costs $40 or $50 to make, then it's $250 product. Nobody's going to buy that. So you can't even pursue it.
Yeah.
So talk to different companies, learn this over months. And I was involved as a partner. He didn't want to spend the full amount for the design. So we said, let's share this if it ever becomes successful. And for years, it wasn't successful. And so what it changed to was, instead of doing this three-dimensional thing where this figure glows, what if we just have it spin in a circle and do a two-dimensional object? And that's going to be a lot easier. It's going to not use 250 LEDs or 50 LEDs. You can use 10 or 15. And now we can get to a price point that's reasonable. And here's the next step of potential, because we were going to license this technology. We were going to find an existing toy company that was already in the business, already had distribution, had stores, had manufacturing, and that we would make an agreement with them and they'd pay us a percentage of their wholesale costs. That's usually how it works. 5% could be 10%. We got what we thought was a really good deal. They were going to pay us 10%. I think it was 10% of wholesale, which was great. You never get that good of a rate, usually for a toy. It's usually fine. The question is, how many of these things are they going to sell? So they were going to do a wholesale cost of, I think it was going to be $10 products, so say $5 wholesale comes right. So we would get 50 cents for each one. So, but the company that we worked with, which is called Toysmith, which is a well-known company, you've probably seen their products. Their products are in every.
Yeah, Toysmith is there.
Royal company. Yeah. We like the people. Good organization.
I met a few people at the Astra trade show.
Yeah, they have a great business and they're good to work.
Yes.
However, for them, they have a huge catalog. They have, I don't know, hundreds, maybe thousands of products. You go to their booth at the trade shows and there's just dozens and dozens of little products. And so for them, a big successful product is it sells 50,000 units or so.
Yeah.
And if we're only making 50 cents each and he and I are splitting it, we're not even going to recoup.
That's one margin in the product.
In the let alone, even if it's successful, because who's going to buy it, right? So our product had like horses and fish. That was the animation that was shown. It was a 2D thing. It was a fan that spun around. It was basically a fan. And you push a button.
Do you have one of those?
I'm going to show you the next one. I'm going to show you where it actually succeeded, which is my next one.
Okay.
So first one, 3D, product worked. Money didn't work out. Second one, product worked. Price point was pretty good. Business partnership wasn't so great because the content was just like a horse jumping over a fence or something. So now we move to the one that's actually successful. And this is all due to my partner, Rufus, who was just doggedly pursuing this over years. He finds a new partner, which is called Candyrific. So Candyrific is a company that had an innovation, a discovery, not related to technology, but related to selling. And their innovation was that if you put a toy in the candy aisle, then you could attract the attention of kids and their parents. So Candyrific sells toys that happen to have a little bit of candy inside, and they have distribution at Walmart, Target, CVS. You see them everywhere. This is an example of one of their toys. We see these things around, and they have all different kinds of products. They have ones that are just fans, and they have ones with Star Wars characters on.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, two innovations here on the business side that I think are interesting. First is it's got candy. So there's candy inside here. You sell the candy aisle. I guess there's three innovations. One is that they take all the cost down, that they're very good at driving the cost down.
Okay.
And the third one is that it's made by Candyrific, but if you're buying this, it's Jurassic Park.
They have licensing. Yes, that's amazing.
So Toy Smith, which was the one that didn't work out, we had the horse jumping over a fence.
Yeah, that's nothing to hide
it. When you work with Candyrific, there's an Elsa Anna. There's a Marvel. There's
on for me. I never seen
so,
that.
So this is if I turn it on, we'll start to see.
Okay.
Jurassic Park. Content. So there's 10 seconds of Jurassic Park content, and
this is cool. Right,
because and then since they're licensing it, there's a Frozen one, and then Avengers stuff. So now we're at a price point off a wholesale cost that's maybe like $3 or something like that.
Are they selling it in Disneyland? This is
selling Disneyland. Yeah, that's one of their customers. So then, and also they're not going to pay a 10% because Disney gets, if Candyrific sells this toy, they got to pay Disney because that's what part of the people are buying it. They're paying Disney. I don't know what they're paying you, 5%.
Yeah. Usually 15% in the licensing industry was a minimum guarantee over 2 years. But that's a typical arrangement.
Yes. So they get 50%. So now we're not getting 10%. We're getting like 3%. And the wholesale cost isn't $5. The cost is $3. However, because of where they are in the candy aisle, the price point, content, they're selling millions.
That
does work as invention licensing. So that was the path that we went on that from a toy that was like this idea, 3D toy, very expensive, 2D toy, found the partner, business part didn't really work, to something that now this is great and it works for them and it works for us. And it's a long time running, you know, successful product. And we helped develop the animation. And I guess I should have said earlier, we did get a patent on this. So that's what they're licensing. But just to tell a story about, you know, this and how they drive cost and what that means if you're developing your own toy, there are 15 little LEDs on here.
It's 15 on it? Okay. There's
15 little tiny LEDs.
Okay.
Now the toy is going to work better. We believed that the visual would look a little better if it was 16.
Oh, you think so?
And we said that it needs to be 16. It can be terrific. They know a lot better than we do. And if we were going to add the 16th LED, they would have to use a different processor, which would cost 18 cents more.
Yeah.
And the other LED. And they said, no way. It's too much. We can't do it. You know, we're not, we don't want to add, I think it was 18 or 16 cents.
You know their number really well.
To the bill of materials, because 16 cents to the bill of materials adds another 50 cents to the wholesale cost and another $2 to the customer, whatever it is. No way. So, and that was stunning to me because, you know, our business optics that we do, a lot of these systems are thousands of dollars or tens of thousands of dollars. And here we are arguing over 16 cents. That was definitely interesting. And of course, the toy industry is very price driven. So if you have an invention, you need to know your numbers and you need to know how you're going to get it to the price.
100%. Especially if you're selling at the volume they are, the margin of like 18 cents can make a huge difference. So that's a very unique story. Thank you so much for sharing that with our audience. My next question is like, how do you stay ahead of all the technology advancement in both the optical engineering, which you specialize in, and also toy design?
I would say that the work that we do is based on physics principles that have been around for hundreds of years. It's mathematics. You know, we're applying it to all different areas. So really our customers are the people who are on the cutting edge. So we have a customer right now who is working on basically optical processing, computer processor that's not electronic, that's doing photonic switching and stuff. This is like really advanced stuff. And we don't really know about that. We don't know how to do that exactly, but we know how to create the lenses and things that do what they need to do. So we're just applying science and physics to these new applications. Same with self-driving cars, right? So it's a laser. We have to have a spot that goes out and hits the scene. We design a lens that makes a laser spot. And then there's a lens that collects the laser spot. So how do you design that? That's what we do. The figuring out all the software of how to make the self-driving car drive, that's other people's expertise. And in terms of the toy industry, in terms of consumer products, I guess what I've been thinking about over the past year since we worked on this licensing is finding ways to do very inexpensively some of the photonics technology that to us seems basic.
So,
I mean, I have another product if you want to see another example product.
Oh, please show us. Yes.
Yeah. So after we did this licensing thing with this thing and I started to learn about that, what other things can we work on it? One of the ideas I had is that I have kids who play hockey. And if you're skating, it's really important to have sharp hockey skates. And you have to get them sharpened every so often. And I wasn't sure how often I need to sharpen them. So I thought maybe we could bring some kind of sensor that would tell me how. So we build a sensor that would tell you how sharp a hockey skate was. However, the hockey skate market is not very big, but the knife market is huge. And they're really isn't any product that's a consumer-based product that tells you how sharp your knife is.
So
I had a product idea that we would come up with a system that would tell you how sharp your knife was rather than just cutting a piece of paper. And so we created this system, which we then licensed to this company called Farberware, which is owned by Lifetime Brands.
Oh, wow. That's pretty cool. How do you use it? You put a blade inside?
So this is basically a kind of a regular knife sharpener. There's a coarse and then fine gear, but this slot is our sensor.
Okay.
And so there is a little optical system inside of here that's going to be looking at the edge of the knife, and it's going to be sensing, is the knife edge sharp or dull? And the way that it's doing that is there's a laser and a photoreceiver, and light is shooting up and hitting the edge of the knife and then bouncing back and telling us how much light is there, and the more light, the duller. So let me just show you how this works.
Interesting.
So this is a I turn on the sensor, okay, and this knife here is sharp at this part, okay, but I intentionally dulled it.
Well, you'll give me a light. Is a light indicator?
A light is indicating it. So if it's green, it's sharp. So it goes sharp here.
Okay.
And then if it's dull, it's red, okay? So that's sharp. It's dull at the end. If it's totally dull, you use the other side of the knife where that's not even cutting, right? The light doesn't even turn on. It's so dull. Let me see if I have a bit. That one is all sharp. What is this one? That one's dull here. I've been dulled it at the end. Okay, this part is sharp. So the way that in the past people tell whether a knife is sharp is they cut hair off their arms. Maybe they cut a piece of paper or something like that. These are very subjective measurements. So there is no and has never been any tool that tells you how sharp your knife is and whether you need to keep sharpening it. Maybe you've sharpened it, you don't know whether you should keep sharpening. That was a product that we invented that uses optics technology. And then we made a prototype. We spent time to figure out, could it be made inexpensively? And we had all that information in a patent. When we had a patent, when we had a prototype, when we had quotes from factories that said, yeah, you could make this for a good price. Then we went to potential licensing partners, including this one, Hardware, to see if they wanted it. And they did. So they gave us a license and they're paying us a percentage. And they're doing that. They did the final design, they did the manufacturing, and then they had good distribution. So they've had this on VC. It's on Amazon. They've had it in different other retailers. But that was taking a complex optics technology and then bringing it in a consumer product.
How long did it take your team to create something as complicated as that?
First, we did skate blades, and that took a while. And then we decided we didn't want to do skate blades. We wanted to do knives. So the knife thing probably took 6 months to develop. And the knife tester took 6 months, but that takes a while to patent. Then it takes a while to find a partner. Then the partner takes a year to bring it out. When you sign a licensing deal, it's usually, they don't know, they're not going to start making it the next day. Usually, that will have a year or something like that. And if they don't start making it, selling it in a year, and then you get your patent back. And if they don't hit certain production volumes, sell a certain number of units, then you get it. Those are the basic things in the licensing deal is, you know, what percentage are we going to get? What are the minimum orders that they're going to give you? What's the timeline? How long are they going to have this exclusivity, assuming they have exclusivity?
It's a very complicated and time-consuming process. Will you mind sharing with the audience how big is your team right now, including yourself?
We have 12 engineers.
Oh, whoa. Yeah.
And most of the time we're working on the optical design stuff.
Yes.
So we did two licensing ones. And then 2 years ago, we thought, let's do our own thing. And again, is there precision technology that we can create something that doesn't exist in the physical world using things that we know about?
Okay.
So this is a roll of tape and just a standard roll of tape. And what I found as I got older, that one, that I needed reading glasses, which I didn't do. I didn't know, but when I turned 40, I started to lose my vision, and that isn't fun. And I would be shipping things to my colleagues, and I would lose the edge of the tape roll, and then I'd waste 5 minutes trying to figure out where it was because I couldn't feel it. I didn't have fingernails, whatever. So we created this little device here, and you put it on the edge of the roll of tape. Okay. And when you roll it around, when it finds the edge, you see that little light coming on? That light is basically telling me that's where the edge is.
Okay. You saved the shipping department a lot of freaking time.
And then, especially when the shipping department is me, or you're returning your Amazon packages or whatever, your home. So then I use the scraper thing. Now that I know where it is, I can use the scraper to pull up the edge and lift it up. And so that's the latest invention, and that's one that we're selling ourselves. And that's also interesting.
How's the sales for this one?
Pretty good. We placed our first order. I think we made 2,000 units to start, and that was about just under a year ago. And we've sold about 1,200 of them. And so it's not a home run yet, but I don't think I think there's a lot more people who get frustrated with tape that we'll be reaching. And we've tried different selling methods, and I've learned we're in Ace Hardware and we're on Amazon and other.
How's the sales on Amazon for this particular product?
I thought Amazon is okay. Sales at Ace Hardware is not too good. I think that I needed to do better packaging, which is something that I learned because this is such a new thing. I would have to do it again. I would do a better package that explained it. Sales on Amazon is tricky because no one is looking for this.
Yeah, that's the old search volume, which is always going to be tricky.
Yeah. It's not like a water bottle that you would search for a water bottle. You could find a better water bottle, but there is no search volume for this. So the thing that has been most helpful is more discovery platforms. There's one called Grommet, which is the discovery platform, and then influencers and stuff. So people going on their Instagram feeds or
Kickstarter campaign for this because it's so innovative.
I didn't. I might. I don't know. I'm kind of scared of Kickstarter. Have you done Kickstarters?
I've done Kickstarter before. Yeah.
They kind of scared me. Yeah.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah, they kind of scared me. You need to build an email list of 5,000 people.
We did a Kickstarter many years ago for one of our weighted toys. So our design is a weighted blanket that you can write on using water pen. It's an interactive weighted blanket. The thing about the demographic that shop on Kickstarter, they are looking for the latest like toys, the latest backpack, the latest board game. They are not looking for a product to help kids with special needs. That's where our audience is. Despite all the marketing effort, we only raised like $10,000 at the end of the campaign, which is not a lot of money. It was a very tricky platform for us, especially for the type of product that we design, which is for kids with special needs. It's a very niche market. But I think for a product that is innovative, that have a mass market approach, and that is also catchy, and people that's like shareable, that's where the Kickstarter can really shine. You want to have product that can potentially go viral.
Right. Right. So you're of that $10,000, how much of that do you think was like Kickstarter and how much of it was just people you sent to Kickstarter?
I would say a lot of it is people we sent to Kickstarter.
Okay. Then you had to find them, right? You had to find them on Facebook or whatever.
Expensive. It is. Like I say, it only worked the best for the product that go viral naturally on the platform.
Yeah.
Then you can drive people in and you create even more of an upward spiral. Then you can raise like millions of money, like dollars. But you require a certain type of product. And unfortunately, the product I tried wasn't one of them.
Yeah. I've been talking recently to distributors in Japan, and there's another Japanese Kickstarter platform. I've forgotten the name. Are you familiar with that one?
I forgot the name as well because I haven't done that in Japan. That's one in Japan.
Yeah, you haven't tried that one.
I haven't tried that one. Yeah, because in Japan it's even worse for my brand. Because talking about the awareness and people not searching for the product that you sell, I have the same exact issue. But in Japan it's even worse because like I shared with you when we first met, there's a huge taboo around disability in Japan in general. Mm-hmm. That's what it forced me and my wife to move from Japan. It's because we couldn't find the help and the support. Means people are also not searching for the type that I create in Japan as much. That's the struggle with, at least for my product. I'm pretty sure some other product might work as long as it's innovative and that's something Japanese consumer like. And that's something I specialize in too. And actually taking and helping some of our clients to launch in Amazon Japan right now with some of their tools.
So what distribution method was most successful for you for that product? Amazon. Okay. Because people were searching for that. They were searching for weighted blankets or something.
Yes. That's search volume in US for my product. Yes. Yeah.
And then you could, because they were looking for weighted blankets, you could be the coolest weighted blanket. You could be the one that was.
Exactly. So as we're winding down in today's interview, the last question I want to get your input on for our listener and the audience that are interested in bringing their own toy design to the market, because you are a really good inventor. You create all this different wonderful product in different spaces across different vertical. What kind of advice will you give someone that's navigating both on the product design side and also on the licensing side? You will give to someone that's new to this industry.
I think solving a problem that you have is good because then you have at least one customer and you can build something that solves it for you. There's probably other people. Second one is you've got to have all of these things. The product has to work. Product has to be able to be manufactured for the right price. You have to have protectable IP or you should. So you have to go through each of these steps, do a patent search to see if somebody's already selling it on Alibaba, find a vendor. You have to figure out all this stuff in tandem before you even really want to put a ton of time. And then if all of those things are green lights, then we need to make a prototype and try it and make sure that you're doing things in small steps. I only made 2,000 my first production run, but as I said, I wished I'd done different packaging. So I probably should have made 500 and then I would have learned the packaging was better because there's just so many to part the path from like your idea to something that's successful. There are so many landmines or pitfalls or traps. If you put too much money or have too much hope or put too much time into any particular idea without thinking about each of those landmines, you're going to run into.
Thank you for sharing that. That's a really good piece of advice. So where can our audience find you online?
I'm on LinkedIn, John Ellis. I think I'm one of the few people, John Ellis in optics. And then also My websites are opticsforhire.com, and this tool is at Roll Ranger. That's the name of the product, rollranger.store.
Thank you so much. And thank you everyone for tuning in to today's episode of Toy Business Unboxed. We hope you enjoy the conversation and find it insightful and inspiring. If you like what you have heard, be sure to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite platform so you never miss an episode. We really appreciate your support and would love it if you could leave us a review and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues. For more resources, tips, and the latest update in the toy industry, visit our website at toy-launch.com and join the next conversation and connect with us on social media using hashtag ToyBusinessUnboxed. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestion for future episodes. Until next time, keep innovating, keep creating, and keep bringing joy to toys. This is Jason Shea signing off from Toy Business Unboxed podcast. See you in the next episode.